red card, goalkeeping errors and a last-ditch equaliser, Reading's game at Brentford on Saturday had all you could want for a thrilling afternoon, except all of those things were provided by the host to make for a curious little 2-2 draw in West London. Welcome to episode 170 of the Tyler Stem podcast. I'm your host, Mark Mayo, as per usual, and join me this week on the other end of the phone line is Will Jones, the Tyler Stem's assistant editor and kind of all-round stats guru, who's actually moving out to Brussels soon. So you'll be part of the Exiles group soon, won't you, mate?
I will indeed, though with the iFollow, these things, it'll actually be quite easy to keep watching Reading, and I might see more of them than what I do now that I live in London.
Yeah, the irony is that it's probably easier for a lot of fans abroad than to make the way on the trains and everything, the unreliable services we get down here in England. So a quick word on what we're going to be doing. Obviously, we'll be covering the Brentford game, but we're going to divert a lot of attention this week to a bit of nostalgia, a look back at the 2008-09 campaign, because it's 10 years ago, and I kind of feel it's one of those that gets swept under the rug a little bit. So we'll be paying a good 10-15 minutes on that in a bit, but we'll crack on now and do the Brentford recap.
View from the Tarhurst end.
Recapping this week's championship action.
On paper, being the first team to take points off of Brentford at home this season feels like a big achievement. I mean, they've only beaten Rotherham, Sheffield Wednesday, Nottingham Forest and Wigan so far. But Will, do you think, you know, now we know that we've taken a point off of a decent team at home, or very good team at home, depending on your point of view, is it a great point? Or obviously, as we know, Reading, with a late equaliser scored against them despite Brentford having 10 men, is this perhaps not as big an achievement as it does appear on paper?
I think if you offered everyone connected to Reading a point on Saturday morning, we would have definitely taken it. At half time, we would have taken it. We were in a strong position, and yes, it is disappointing. The red card actually happened late in the game, so I think even that, when you consider that, doesn't add to the sort of disappointment. Brentford are a very good team. I mentioned in the podcast of the Bolton game that I saw them play Rotherham the first game of the season. And out of all the championship games involving Reading so far, I've seen, Brentford were better than everyone else. So actually, this was a good point. And I was getting a little bit concerned. You know, the one sort of thing about as great as the victory over Hull was, Reading's results against teams, better teams than them, they haven't had one of those for a while. So actually, it is a good result. And to score two goals, and, you know, by the sound of things, we actually frustrated them pretty well, going by Dean Smith's comments.
Yeah, I think frustrating them is the key word, really, isn't it? Because Reading just tipped over 30% of the ball possession, which isn't very much, and certainly isn't as much as we've been seeing Reading have lately. I mean, it's a bit of a failure to keep hold of a lead in any game. It was 14 minutes that Brentford had after that red card because there were 10 minutes of stoppage time. Clement, look, on the face of it, Clement didn't necessarily do much to prevent Brentford scoring. He traded his wingers off the bench, and then in the 90th minute he brought Liam Kelly on for John Swift, which isn't too much. Reading seemed to lose control of the game. And I mean, do Reading at the moment have it in them necessarily to bring on, I mean, obviously David Milo, John O'Shea not being fit, there wasn't much scope to really change much of the team.
Yeah, the options aren't really there on the bench. I'm just, you know, looking at the unused subs. You've got McNulty, you're not going to bring him on. Tyler Blackett, you could, if you wanted to sort of put an extra centre back on or someone of height, you do that. So you've got Rinam Hota, bit inexperienced, you know, no reason not to throw him on, but unless he's a sort of defensive player or whatever, is he going to offer something that, say, Kelly with more experience wouldn't? So the options weren't there on the bench. It can be a bit dangerous when you've been naturally defensive all game, that sort of the last 10 minutes you just get further and, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper. And that, you know, if that's, it sounds like what's happened here.
Yeah, it's weird. I looked at the highlights, and it's an odd one to look at in the sense of judging how the game went based just on the highlights, because both of our goals, both the Reading goals, were actually quite jammy. The keeper makes massive errors off two Swift attempts, and John Daddy Bodvarsson is poaching for both of them. I think one might have crept over the line for Swift to claim it rather than Bodvarsson, who got the other one, and obviously his goal scoring record, him being there for both of them, shows he's still on form and doing good stuff, which is nice. I think Sam Baldock was out of the squad entirely with some sort of injury, so Yaku Mase and Mo Barrow were the ones who started on the flanks. Josh Sims, Probably, and Liam Kelly as well, probably a bit harshly dropped. But do you get the sense that Paul Clement is picking his sort of horses for courses teams at the moment? He's going through and saying, right, well, we've got to play a certain way against certain teams. Against Hull at home, you can afford to put someone like Sam Baldock on the left flank because he's quite pacey. You're going to get in the box and that's going to sort itself out. But away at Brentford, maybe he's just kind of reining it in a little bit. And Mate's quite physical, Barrow quick on the counter. Do you think it makes sense?
Yeah, I think Mate in for Sims is that offers a little bit more of an aerial threat and a physical. There, you know, if you look at the probably Brentford's potentially their star player is Ollie Watkins on the left wing, and that's why Mate was probably there just to sort of track a little bit more than Sims would, and then Swift, given that he was responsible for two of the goals in for Kelly, you can't argue with. What will be interesting to see is if how much change there is on Tuesday.
Tuesday night, well, we'll come on to it a bit later, but I think it's just going to be the back to, hopefully, sort of back to how we played against old John O'Shea. Is he back? I believe he is going to be back for that. So, yeah, we'll talk about that a bit later on. But more questions, sort of, as you've alluded to. The Brentford goals, then, let's kind of talk about those. I felt like for the first one, very early in the game, Reading haven't really conceded that early in games under Paul Clement, but this one was only about 6 minutes in. Felt like Thiago Alori and Chris Gunter kind of got bullied for it, just ball into the box, and neither of them quite aware and quite able to clear it. The second one, ball into the box again. Nice flick on at the near post, yes it was. However, Sam Walker kind of caught in no man's land for it and perhaps switched off a little bit or wasn't quite as focused on the game as perhaps the moment of the game that it was. Watching those back, are there any other thoughts you have on that?
Well, the first goal is a classic Brentford goal. If you watch enough of their highlights of the season, they really are big on these low crosses into the box. And you know, Mopoi, who scored the goal, that a lot of his ones happen in that area. So you could say it's a little bit disappointing, given that Brentford's sort of tactics and qualities around that we, you know, weren't aware of that. They're quite good at sort of getting out wide and then recycling, sort of pulling the ball back a little bit more central and putting those balls in. So maybe a little bit disappointed that we weren't more wise to that. And then the sort of the equaliser is the classic, let's throw everyone in the box, and you've just got to sort of stand tall. Once you have too many men in the 6-yard box, then it's almost, you know, becomes a bit of a luck, really. You know, if it's a good delivery and who gets up highest, you need to sort of try and find a way of being a bit more in control of the situation. If you do look at Walker's position, you might be a bit disappointed with that.
And Liam Moore was the man who got beaten on the line. But, I mean, Liam Moore versus Barbe, obviously, it's a bit of a physical mismatch there. Despite Liam Moore as good a defender as he is, sometimes he is limited by his physicality sort of deficit that he has there. The tireless end ratings then that Bucks Royal has done for us, John Swift and Ezra Talahi both picked up 8s. It's a bit of a return to midfield 3 paying off at the moment. I've moved, for the purpose of this show, because we've only got a couple of questions on the mailbag, I've moved the mailbag questions that we've had into the recap. And Shane Keane tweeted us saying, great result, but disappointing by the way it happened. Saeed Ezra Talahi was amazing. Swift was really good as well. But do you think Clement should have done some more in the last few minutes to stop the late goals? And on the point of Ezra Talahi and Swift, it really seems like, certainly with Ezra Talahi, that he's found someone, Clement has, that he's happy to trust pretty much no matter what.
Yeah, it sounds promising so far. We've really sort of lacked that defensive midfielder who's got a bit of physical presence, can get about, but is also good on the ball, and he's ticking those 3 boxes at the moment, which is good. I think Swift has actually sort of shown promise before now, but just maybe the rest of the team's not been connecting with him. So it's really good to see him getting good, and hopefully that partnership will only get better. And then you start to sort of think, well, Bodvarton's scoring, Bulcock scoring as well, Yiadam's playing well, and Barrow, you know, throughout his time at Reading, he's occasionally hit and miss, but he's always got that threat. And you start to think, you know, if we can get a little run here, we could do okay. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, but we can hopefully put a little bit of distance between us and the relegation zone. I mean, the only thing I could look at sort of from a stats-wise from yesterday is we talked about how Reading sat deep. Having only 250 passes and, you know, Sam Walker being the player who put the most passes tells you that there was a lot of work without the ball, which is not necessarily a bad thing if you're sort of defensively solid. But what you don't want to do is get into the habit of playing that, and actually when you do get on the ball, you almost don't know what to do it, and you start to make attacking look difficult. But saying that, we have scored 5 goals in a week, so that's promising.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago that Reading scored 5 goals in a... I suppose it was obviously recently that we scored 5 goals in a week, but it felt like there was a long period of time between, you know, when Reading used to do it and Reading have picked up doing it again of late. So it's nice to have that sort of that stat to fall back on. The other question that we had in this week was from Neil via Twitter, saying, while Mate may be a cult hero, do you believe that he should be in the starting lineup? I think we kind of covered that as kind of horses for course at the moment, and if Clement feels confident doing that, then if that's his tactical sort of mantra, then I'm perfectly happy with it. And I don't necessarily expect Mate to start again on Tuesday night against QPR. Similarly, Neil asked, should O'Shea come straight back in? And if so, who drops out? I mean, I'd perfectly happily go back to the Thiago Alori at right back end and Chris Gunter to the bench. And Neil also mentions Ezra Talahi, and maybe we should be making his move permanent. Perhaps 2 games isn't quite enough. God knows what sort of details and clauses and fees Ruben Kazan will be asking for a player like Saeed Ezra Talahi, but it's perhaps going to be a theme that we'll have to start discussing in the few weeks ahead. And we'll talk about the lineup a little bit more for QPR on the preview. So to move the podcast forward, let's move ahead then and do the pub chat, because we want to have a good little look into the 2008-09 season and all that went on then, as it's 10 years ago this season.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
Well, it feels perhaps a bit longer than 10 years ago now that we were signing Noel Hunt, and we were starting the first game of the season with Stephen Hunt at left back, and we were letting Glenn Little, Dave Kitson, Nicky Shorey and Ibrahima Sonko go, although to be fair, 3 of those players did come back pretty sharply in the end. What's your sort of, before we dig into the detail, what's your initial memories of the 2008-09 campaign?
I went to the first game of the season against Nottingham Forest, and using that game as a sort of the example, that was the only season in my 25 years of supporting Reading where Reading felt like a big club in the Championship. You know, we turned up and teams wanted to beat us because we were a scalp. And on that Nottingham Forest game, they'd just been promoted from League One and they've got a big stadium. They're a club with history. But I just sort of remember going there thinking, you know, a bit disappointing. It almost sort of hadn't got over the relegation. But I have a memory and, you know, of Nottingham Forest fans singing, "You're Not Famous Anymore." And the idea of Nottingham Forest singing that to Little Reading, I mean, in 2018 is hilarious. But that, you know, it made sense. Then I come at dinner, the next game we played Plymouth at home, and I just remember being sort of taken aback by, after all the years of watching Championship, Division One, whatever you want to call it, football, been taken aback by the drop in quality from the Premier League. And I can remember sort of having almost a 1v1 and just thinking, he's not going to score. This is Plymouth. This is the Championship. It will be all right. And it was almost a slight sense of it maybe at times being a bit too easy, and it was sort of enjoyable watching us thump teams. But similarly, I also remember thinking, we just got to get through this season. So it wasn't a sort of a promotion of, you know, every win and getting excited. It was like, we just got to get through this. And I almost sort of was thinking about this when knowing that we were going to talk about it, whether that was where it came out, because there wasn't that excitement or the real joy of winning and being near the top. It was like, we just got to get through the season and get back to being in the Premier League. That when it actually became a struggle, it was like, is it actually, you know, we didn't almost have that enjoyment to go back on because we were expected to win. We expect to be promoted.
The thing is, the second away game we had that season was away at Charlton. I think it was on Sky Sports, I seem to remember, really. We lost 4-2. And it was, you know, they were saying afterwards, oh, it's one of the games of the season, all that sort of stuff. And I sat there like, well, we've lost away to Charlton, who, you know, they were in the Premier League relatively recently, but they're not very good. And it just felt kind of odd. And a couple of weeks after that, I went away to the Ipswich game, which we lost 2-0 with kind of 2 late goals. And again, it was an odd feeling that we weren't necessarily making an impact on these sort of games. And as Reading, we felt we should be. I remember I was looking through the stats for the start of the season, and we won 7 and drew 1 of our first 8 home games, but we only won 1 of our first 7 away games. And did that kind of give us a false sense of security? Because we were thumping Sheffield Wednesday and Swansea, it kind of felt like we were back to normal. But there were sort of cracks, certainly away from home, that were quite evident.
Yeah, I can remember losing to, going to the games against Preston, away at Preston and Burnley, and narrowly defeats. But it sort of couldn't be more different from this season, because we'd lose these games and you'd be thinking, how on earth, why are we losing to these teams? It might have been a hangover actually of Premier League arrogance, that the sort of thing that we hate now is that we shouldn't be losing to Plymouth, Ipswich, Charlton, Preston and Burnley. These teams are below us, but also just seeing the quality and like, why aren't we doing it? You know, why can we do it at home, but we can't do it in a way? And I remember the Burnley game being really angry and almost like feeling the players were starting to sort of drop their heads, and that was autumn. And given them what started to happen, maybe I wasn't far off it. But it was a very sort of strange, because at times we were just way too good for the division. And then you'd have these other games where it was just a real struggle and we'd lose.
One of the weirdest moments of the season was the ghost goal that we scored away to Watford. And at that moment, I remember thinking, you know, because we were national news to a large extent then. And I was kind of thinking like, oh yeah, this is what it was like to be back in the news stories. We'd had, you know, 3-4 months of not being in the news at all, having had 2 years of Premier League level attention, and that sort of was a bit of a jolt as well. The new year came in, I remember going to Birmingham and we won 3-1 there. The week after that, Adam Federici scored a 96th minute equaliser at home to Cardiff. That put us second, and at that point it really was a case of here we go. You know, the away form had kind of sorted itself out. We were introducing some new kids into the team. There were like Alex Pearce, Jem Carachan, Shane Long was obviously having a bigger role to play, as well as James Henry and Julian Kelly. As the new year started, we were second in the table, and that was, you know, back to the old days, classic Reading, Coppell, here we go.
Yeah, and I think there was the famous game where we played Wolves on a Tuesday night, and when we beat them, and the Reading fans sung, we'll be top by Saturday, and we never were top. And in fact, I think that was the game. You look back at the results after that, it was almost sort of where the really odd slip, a drop in form started to happen. It really was a bizarre season. You know, you met sort of the ghost goal. You mentioned Federici scoring against Cardiff. And then the way the season went from having really good home form but bad away form to just completely flip that around. And yeah, we went from it being too easy to suddenly being a real struggle. Some of the games you just watching, and you just thought, we're never going to score here. You know, we're not even creating chances, let alone scoring a goal.
Well, we failed to score in 9 of the last 17 games in the league, and that is a staggering. I mean, that's bad for a relegation sort of candidate team, but a staggering for a team that was hoping. And the promotion race was completely open, even winning the championship was still a possibility at this stage. In February was that sort of this turn, of, as you say, the nightmare turn. We had 1 point from a run of 3 home games against Preston, Bristol City and Nottingham Forest in a week. Ipswich and Sheffield United also came down and claimed 1-0 wins. Charlton and Barnsley came to the Madstad and drew. And that bad home form carried on into the Brendan Rodgers era quite significantly as well. And do you think, in hindsight, do you think it was a bad idea to bring back Glenn Little and Dave Kitson for the run-in? Because we signed them in March on loan, and that was that perhaps a bit of a desperate attempt?
Yeah, it was. Little did nothing. Kitson scored, I think it was a couple of goals. He scored a nice one at Doncaster.
One I can remember.
I can't remember if he scored another one. But they looked, it almost felt symbolic that Little and Kitson came back and were clearly not their old selves. Coppell had lost it. Hunt's and Doyle's form had dropped off. It just felt like everything from the golden era was just, it was very much coming to an end of an era. It was quite sad to watch, really, how these players who just 2 years ago were tearing up in the Premier League, and now they were struggling against teams that were being relegated from the Championship, and it wasn't one-offs, it was started to happen on a weekly basis.
And it all came to a head then with that Birmingham final game of the season. It was classic big game Reading fluff. What were your memories of that game? Kevin Phillips broke free, a bit of an offside trap that he rolled past the goalkeeper again. And then Matiowski got us back into it. But to be honest, it was one of those days, and it certainly another one of those days came very shortly after that, where you thought that no matter how long we played it, the massive comeback, the sort of salvation moment of the Hollywood moment before the credits roll, it just wasn't going to come.
Yeah. It was a very tense game, and nothing really happened until that howler from Hahnemann. Was the howler the first goal or the second goal?
Yeah, the first goal, because the second goal, Phillips was in front of the north stand, I seem to remember.
Yeah, but once it went 2-0, you know it was over. And then we got the Matiowski goal, and you thought that sort of gave us a little bit of faint hope, which was a good goal. And Matiowski was a very strange player and actually seemed to do better off the bench. By that point, you knew that Reading were not going up, and no one had any really hope for the playoffs. It was you just wanted the season over, and out of all the sort of playoff campaigns that we've had, I think that was the one that everyone expected to lose, and would, as the low attendance in the second leg showed, people had lost hope.
Only 19,500 people turned up for that second leg, and I think it was probably the main problem for me was at that time that Burnley were the Reading of 3 years ago, in a sense, weren't they? They're the team every year in the playoffs. You think it was the Huddersfield a couple of years ago as well, that when there's a team that's coming up and they've never been in the Premier League before and they've got a great squad unity, they don't even have to have the best players, because we went to Turf Moor and dominated that first game and had a number of chances to win it before Andre Bique had a nightmare, is the kind way of putting it, I think. But Burnley were truly the team, the sort of the chosen one of that season. And, the fact that we started Simon Church in the second leg, I think, just showed how far off the pace we were.
Yeah, Burnley, Swansea, Huddersfield. You're right. They weren't the best teams in the division, but they were good teams in all of the ones. They had real spirits. And because they're at the Premier League, it was their real excitement in the towns and in the stadiums. Very similar clubs to Reading. Simon Church being thrown in, there were a few rumours of Copple having a real bust up with Stephen Hunt, and or maybe it might have been Kitson or both of them. And I think that was it. It was just, what else should I try and do? Why not? And Church, actually, I remember sort of doing okay. He put a one over cross, but whilst we in the first leg, we actually looked okay. And there was one moment I can remember where Kebe was running through, and it was a 2v1.
I
think he tried to cross to Kitson, but I remember Kitson's run just being all terrible. Like, Kitson somehow managed to just time his run to perfection so that the one Burnley defender was bang in the middle between them, so it didn't really give Kebe an option. And in hindsight, Kebe should have just shot, and the Kebe of a sort of a few years later would have done. But that was sort of, again, a sign of sort of Kitson's being off it, that he couldn't time his run. And then, in the second leg, we never looked like scoring. And the sort of two goals in the second half was just a sort of real slow end and a sad way for Copple to go out.
It was kind of typical, because I remember that first leg, I remember me and my dad left immediately after the final whistle. There aren't many games where we do that. Certainly I can't think of any off the top of my head where we've done that. And that was the kind of the disappointment, the anger of the moment that we'd wasted. The second leg, at the final whistle, everyone just kind of sat there and just sort of sighed, not like a sigh of relief, but just sighed that it was inevitable. It was always going to sort of come to that head, that sort of bad end at some point. And it felt as if Copple resigning that night as well, it was natural that it ended that way. The manager and team had both lost momentum and motivation as well in the second half. And Copple had almost resigned the year earlier. So maybe, I'm not suggesting he should have, but maybe history would be different if he had done.
Yeah, you almost wonder if like we'd had Rodgers to come in a year earlier with the better players, whether, you know, that probably would have worked out for Rodgers better. But, you know, we all wanted Koppel to stay, and then he did it. Yeah. And it was sort of working, but it was a strain. You know, the fact he was clearly losing his love for a bit here, and I think he just sort of naturally wanted a break. There were a few players, well, not whose heads had been turned. It wasn't a happy place, and in some ways, that sort of legacy. You know, we talk about 10 years. We had a brief bit under McDermott, but that's kind of what Reading's been like since then. We've never, I don't think we've ever really got over that relegation in 2008. Even the sort of the season when we won promotion in 2012, a little bit helped you, but it kind of made me more get over sort of seeing Swansea up there. But even now, I mean, maybe it's because I'm sort of that particular era where I grew up with that team, and the sort of 2005 to 2017 were the last sort of team I could look up to, you know, as older than me, and, you know, maybe heroes is too strong a word, so it was that thing. But as a club, you know, it really did feel like we've made it, we're going places, and since then it really hasn't. You know, even that promotion to the Premier League, it felt like we're going to struggle here. I mean, when we went up in 2005, we thought we're going to make a real go of it, and we did. 2012, you knew we were going to struggle, and we felt like we were going out with a weaker squad and a smaller and less ambitious club.
My last point on this, and I'm interested if people want to send in their sort of emails and tweets about this, and obviously if they want us to review any old seasons that perhaps we haven't really touched on, trying to, you know, as the season goes on, just dropping a bit of nostalgia in here and there, I'm more than welcome people to email in thetylerstead@gmail.com. My final question on this is, do we underrate or underestimate this as an achievement? We were 6 points off second. Yes, we finished fourth in a three-horse race, sort of a bit of terrible sounding, you know, terrible definition of it, but that's nonetheless true. But in terms of Reading history and the amount of money that we spent in the summer, which was basically zip, we obviously made a profit given the fact that we sold Nicky Shorey and didn't sign that many players. Is it underestimated as an achievement to have got that far once again with that team? And as you say, that a lot of those players had their heads turned, and in reality, apart from maybe Kevin Doyle and Stephen Hunt, weren't necessarily that good at that point or from the future then on. So do you think there's a sense that it's maybe underestimated?
A little bit. If you put it in the wider context, if you compare it to 2012-13, when there was a little bit more investment, and yes, the team that went down was weaker, was a weaker one than the 2007-8 team. But that team, we didn't even reach the playoffs, and, you know, apart from two or three games, never looked good. Whilst the 2008-9, there were periods where we were really good. You know, I would almost put it at the same level as the 106 team, you know, beating teams 6-0, Doyle scoring two hat-tricks in a row, not far off getting a third one, going away to Wolves, winning 3-0, Birmingham. There were some, in terms of individual performances of what Reading have done in the second tier, it was right up there. But my memory will always be that sort of, I think a lot of people have said this, of finishing fourth in a three-horse race, and it did feel like we underachieved, and it's just hard to sort of separate that season from the season before of being relegated and feeling that we really shouldn't have been relegated, and certain players and the team had let themselves down and they really needed to get back up and prove that that was a blip, and it proved it wasn't. So it was like a double disappointment. It was 2 years of disappointments together.
Yeah, it truly is very difficult to uncouple those two seasons. And yeah, I think my feeling on it is that the years after that showed that Reading were still a good team and did still have the capability of producing good players, as the academy players that I mentioned, and the ability to go and pick out some nice little foreign or sort of lower league talents and bring them through. So Reading did still have it in them at that point, perhaps with a little bit more investment or a little bit more risk taking here or there. We could have done it, or maybe even if we'd have changed manager about sort of March, April time. Obviously, no one really called for it at the time, but with hindsight, who knows, maybe if Koppel would have stepped back and handed over the reins to someone else as a bit of a hybrid system, hindsight is always a wonderful thing in looking back at these seasons. And, you know, to finish off the show, we'll bring us back into the future, or the present and the future, because we'll look ahead to QPR on Tuesday.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.
Tuesday at 8 p.m, Reading return to the Mad Stad to face the fake hoops of QPR, and this is the true litmus test to see if Reading have really turned a corner on their recent results. Defeat against Steve McLaren's team will pretty much, no matter what, be seen as a huge disappointment and a big setback on what Paul Clement and his team have been working towards in recent weeks. And, you know, QPR come into this game on a bit of a dodgy turn of form. They had their slight upturn in the few weeks before their three defeats in a row. They're the lowest scorers in the Championship. They've got the second worst defence too. And they're kind of relying on the young wingers come forward, Emirechi Etsy. Kind of risky strategy, to be honest. You've got Naki Wells and Tammy Hemed. They haven't got going. They're struggling for goals. And they're two players that Reading fans have coveted for some time. And it's really interesting to see how they might come back to haunt us. So, Will, what are your sort of thoughts going in to Tuesday night?
So I think with the QPR game, we've had the two good results, but this is the one that will sort of show if we've turned the corner. You know, if we get a win, then you'll think, oh, actually, we've got to gain a bit of distance between us and the relegation zone. If we lose, on the other hand, then it will feel a bit like the Norwich game, where it's one step forward, one step back. Maybe it's because of QPR, it feels like a classic midweek Reading defeat coming up. You know, Naki Wells, I don't think he scored for QPR, always scores against Reading, and that's there. QPR seem to be a bit of a funny team, where with the first, was it four defeats in the row, and you're thinking that dead certs. They've actually sort of turned it around. So, you know, they're not going to roll over, but Reading needs to be positive here. I'm sort of half wondering whether to say a draw is not a disaster, but I feel we've got to be positive, and we really should be getting a win. And then if we do get the win, that means that we go into the West Brom game almost like we've got nothing to lose here. And that's whilst we probably are with a mentality of we need to stay up, that's what we need to do. We need to be picking up points, and this is quite clearly one of those games. It's a six-pointer. We win this, there's a distance relegation zone, got a momentum, and then that sort of means that this sort of chunk of the season between the September-October international break, we can be pretty pleased with our work.
Yeah, and we can't forget that the international break does come in after that West Brom game, which we will be having previewed on the Tarlhurst End podcast by Ollie in his preview show on Thursday. Final thoughts on QPR then. You know, we've won three in a row at home versus QPR, so I'm going to go with the prediction of a 2-0 Reading victory. The predictions for Brentford, by the way, for the prediction league, across the board defeats, which have been shunned, and no points for that, apart from Sim Bucksboy or Pickup, who predicted a 1-1 draw, so he picks up a point, but everyone else wrong. So not too much movement on the prediction league front. And we move now into the Tuesday night game, with an eye pretty much on the 3 points, and I should imagine when I get the predictions from the guys, that'll be pretty clearly into the victory category. So, Will, thank you very much for joining us this Sunday evening recording, a bit of an early one, to get it in before the QPR game.
All right, thanks a lot, Mark.
And thank you to all of you listening at home and on your commute or wherever you listen to this podcast. We always fully appreciate it, and there is nothing that will be more appreciated on this podcast and this football club than 3 points against Steve McLaren's QPR on Tuesday night. I mean, really, it's just one of those games that perhaps is a little bit embarrassing to lose. So after the late equaliser on Saturday night, let's go and make sure that Tuesday night is 3 points for the Royals. Come on, your arse. It's the head crowns like Steve and Trev, but he had a crowd.
you smile. Funny how the crowns always be betrayed, even when it seems on your tail. Funny how I always be betrayed. You smile, why? Why do you sit on this side of the tree? Please tell me why. Why don't you break this old biscuit? Just starting to see, kissing out.